Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Lockdown Toronto. I really appreciate you coming back on and checking out the cast. And we've been having a great time so far with great guests, and today is no exception. Today, we are talking about planning once again. This is the Plandemic Podcast, part two. Last week was, or the week before, was Richard White, who helped us through some of the history of planning. And today, I have a special guest. His name is Matt Elliott. He's a Toronto-based freelance contributing columnist for the Toronto Star. He also writes for the CBC and is the author of City Hall Watcher, an independent City Hall newsletter. You can follow him on Twitter, at Graphic Matt, and you would do good to do so because he is a font of information. He does all the hard work, all the data-driven hot takes, and you get so much insight into the numbers and the analysis behind all the policies that come forward, not just at the city level, but region-wide and the like. And again, I want to welcome to the show Matt Elliott. Matt, welcome.
Glad to be here. It's going to be fun.
So, initially, I wanted to bring you on for a discussion about city planning and what does that look like in the pandemic, and during lockdown, and in the short and medium and long term range. But I would be remiss if I didn't address some of the elephants in the room currently happening. I mean, there's a lot of discussion around defunding police, and I know you've done a lot of analysis on police budgets and the policies that underpin them and undergird them, and I wanted your take on this just because I value it so much. What are your thoughts about the current conversations surrounding defunding the police force, especially when it comes to the Toronto context?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is this came out of really awful circumstances, you know, the death of George Floyd in the U.S. and incidents in Toronto, police-involved violence, racist violence, just really terrible situation. But, you know, if we can find something to come out of this that could be positive, I do think the police budget in Toronto is $1.08 billion a year. It's about 10% of all city spending. It's a huge percentage of where your property taxes go in the city. On the average property tax bill, it's about $730 a year just to the police per household. So we're talking about a massive, massive part of the budget. And the challenge I've seen at City Hall and all the time I've been following it is just that, you know, every other part of the city budget will get all kinds of scrutiny. Mayors and councillors will come in, and there are exceptions, but for the most part, I'm speaking generally, it'll be, you know, we really got to look at the parks budget or the budget for affordable housing or TCHC or, you know, all of these things, you know, take a magnifying glass and really just scrutinize every dollar. And then it's like, oh, and there's the police. And the police are the biggest line in the budget, but they just have not gotten that level of scrutiny that you expect for a area of the budget that has increased its spending over the years and has also racked up this long list of issues, should we say, that, you know, Black leaders and activists have done a great job of pointing out. So I think there's a real opportunity here to look at that. For the first time, we're seeing, you know, movement. It's way different. I was thinking today about, you know, the Rob Ford years, 2010 to 2014. And
we're all traumatized by those years.
Yeah. One of the things that administration did is they announced, you know, every department, you got to find 10% off your budget, you know, 10% off your budget, cut it. Except for the police. Police, it was like, you just keep doing what you're doing. We're fine with you. Again, the biggest part of the budget, we're just not going to worry about. But the childcare department, go find 10%. And it really speaks to where priorities have been. And I think now we're starting to see a realization that priorities should shift a little bit. So Councillor Josh Matlow and Councillor Kristen Wong Tam have written a motion that will ask the police to lower their budget request for 2021 by 10%. And I think that's a really interesting, apparently it's because councillors, it's for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is that councillors are getting just flooded with emails demanding cuts to the police budget or defunding the police budget. And it feels different this time. You know, there's been movements over the years for maybe a little bit of control on police spending. John Tory did sort of freeze it for a brief amount of time, but this feels like a grassroots movement that could make a difference, and we'll really be interested to see where it goes.
And I've been in agreement with that too. I mean, setting aside the Rob Ford years or even the Tory years, I mean, under Lastman, it was impossible. Under Miller, it was impossible to move the police force. And I mean, there are different elements as to why. Why would you? But from your perspective, why is it that the inertia of the police budget is so robust that no politician or political force seems to be able to move it? And even in this environment, it's a huge uphill battle.
Yeah, and I mean, it's the situation in Toronto, and I would guess other Canadian cities, is different than in the U.S. In the U.S., municipalities have strong mayor systems. There's a lot of cases where a mayor can just up and fire a police chief or demand an officer gets fired. But here we have some barriers that are really just structural in terms of we have a police board. It's a mix of appointees from the city and the province. So you have different, control levers being pulled there that you need to deal with. It's very hard to fire police officers, as we've seen. They often get suspended with pay, even if they've been charged with a crime, which is a whole other situation. And then you have a situation where, the mayor is, the police board will and can make decisions about the budget. The police chief still has a great deal of independent power on his own to set how those funds are going to be used. So there's a lot of structural stuff that needs to be thought about. It's not just as simple as saying, cut $100 million out of the budget, because then you could have a situation where the police could say, okay, we're going to cut that $100 million from, mental health supports that we do, or, service and like leave some of the stuff where it's just, police officers going in with weapons or whatever as the priority. So there's a need to really look at the structural stuff as part of this, and that's in the motion that's been drafted. So I was glad to see that. I think the other bit is just the perception from councillors, a lot of councillors, especially suburban councillors, is that the police are popular. And funding the police is a popular thing to do, especially, if there is a summer where there is a higher rate of shootings. The default position is that the assumption that people want more police as a response to that. And we saw that last summer. There were some, high-profile shooting incidents in the city, terrible stuff. And the move from council was, okay, we got to look at bringing in hundreds more police officers. So I think the thing that is really important this time around is for people to talk to their councillors and send the message, to say, we know you think that we love the idea of hiring more police officers all the time, but we don't. And we'd be fine if you voted differently on right. some of these motions that are coming out of this.
And Councillor Carroll in the last episode highlighted the fact that, at least in her on a personal level, there have been police intimidation tactics used against city councillors. We know mm-hmm. that was a common occurrence in the past. I mean, during the early Miller years, there was wiretapping and smear tactics used in the press. From where, it's still unclear, but that also could be a contributing factor in terms of the political inertia that tends to happen around police. I mean, on one end, they could be very popular in the suburbs, for sure, and then on the other end, people might just fear taking the lead on an initiative or a policy that can appear anti-police.
Yeah, I definitely think you look at the history and there are lots of stories about that. And some might say that, that's a thing of the past and they cleaned up their act. And, I wouldn't know enough to say either way. But I do think there's this. I remember talking to a councillor once, or somebody who was running for council and wasn't successful. And we were talking about the budget and how the police budget was so big and what could be done about it. And I'll always remember what they said to me. They said, I can't win an election running against the police, and there was so much in that statement and, what it implied and what it could have implied. And, it's something you'd really have to dig into. But that, I think, sort of crystallized it for me, is that there's just this general belief that if you stand up and run for office and specifically run a campaign that's centered around reining in police spending or reforming the police, it's going to be an uphill battle for you.
Right, right. And in terms of that uphill battles, what are your thoughts about the outgoing police chief leaving? Why would you think that is? What do you suspect is behind that reason, other than the stated ones?
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty clear that this was just a matter of he felt it was time, wanted to spend more time with his family, all that stuff. I did sort of take note last year when it came time to extend his contract. He was on a 5-year contract, and they gave him a 1-year extension and not another 5-year extension. So, you know, that might be a piece of it, is the, maybe the writing was on the wall that, you know, come April 2021, there would be a desire in the board for a new police chief. But I mean, it is, you know, the context of this is fascinating because it comes amidst all of the protests that we're seeing. It comes amidst this new call for reining in police spending. It also comes at a time when the city is facing like a total mess from COVID costs. Mm-hmm. And the next budget, even, you know, if there is some federal and provincial money coming to the city, it's still going to be a really, really hard lift to look at, you know, how does the city get through the next budget cycle and the one after that and the one after that. So they might be just sort of surveying that landscape and saying, okay, you know what, it's time to jump off now. I do sort of feel like it looked like there was a bit of a narrative that was attempting to be built with this idea, mm-hmm. that, you know, he would go to this protest and he would take a knee and then announce his retirement. And I'm not sure that played out the way that, you know, maybe he was hoping it would play out. But
right.
I do think we sort of ultimately have to listen to what the chief said. And also, you know, this is not somebody just skipping town. He's sticking around through July 30th, through the end of July. So, you know, this, it feels pretty calculated as, you know, wanting to leave under his own terms.
Gotcha. So one last question about the police, and then we can move on to the other topic that I want to touch on. Often cited is the Camden, New Jersey model of abolishing the police versus simply defunding it or reducing its funding. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that is a possibility to be explored within Toronto? And what are your thoughts on that?
I do. I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking, you know, the way that I would approach this is to make a list of all the things the police do or are supposed to do that is valuable to the city, you know? Mm-hmm. So that could be things as simple as, you know, like I want somebody who gives tickets to cars that park in bike lanes. You know, I want somebody who's making sure that drivers aren't going very fast. I want somebody who can respond if somebody is in a mental health crisis, things like that. And then instead of just saying, okay, all these things are in a bucket that must be delivered by something called the police, maybe there are ways where you go down that list and you say, you know what, actually that responding to people who are having a mental health crisis, that can be done by people who are trained to respond to mental health emergencies and healthcare workers. And, you know, maybe we don't need police officers armed with guns and trained on how to use this kind of stuff to give people tickets when they park in bike lanes. You know, maybe
right.
even that can just be something that's done with cameras and we don't even need to involve that many people like they're doing with the speed cameras. So, yeah, I think that exercise would be fascinating to go through and really look at it. And I think what you'd come away with is a real notion that a lot of the way this is structured with the police service is just structured because of it was structured like this, you know, decades ago.
Yeah.
And you know, you look at the origins of policing and why it started and why it grew the way it did. And I always think it's valuable to think, okay, if we were starting a city like Toronto now, starting fresh, you know, what would we keep and what wouldn't we keep? And I don't think we would say we're going to spend $1 billion on the police. I think we'd say, you know, we do need some emergency response. There's fire and EMS as well. And, you know, there's some role for public safety, but to structure it like this and give the police the power that they do structurally to control what they do, I don't think in a million years you'd do it like this.
Right.
So I really think it's interesting to, you know, I just love to do that exercise. It's the kind of report that I love to read. You know, I love, I'm a nerd. I like to read reports. So
and it's the report that I, it's the report that I love that you love to read it so that I can get the digested analysis afterward.
That's right. There'll be some charts in there. I'm sure it'd be really fun. So that's what I'm hoping for. If we can get to there, that would be fantastic. And I mean, there's so many people in the city now speaking out about this. So I wouldn't say I'm optimistic, because I'm never super optimistic about stuff happening at City Hall. But, you know, if you look at where this issue was last year and where it is now, it's, or even 2 months ago, 3 months ago, it's moved.
Well, let's hope it goes in it's whatever direction it's going to go, and it's going to be super interesting. And I'm fascinated by the current conversation. I thought it would never happen that the public would reach such a fever pitch around this issue. But moving on to the other topic that I would like to drill down into, and that's urban planning, that's urbanism and city density and all the lovely kind of geeky things around that. You penned a column for the Toronto Star titled, where is it here? Oh, yeah. COVID-19 hotspots shouldn't make us rethink cities. They should make us rethink poverty. And this is an argument that I've been trying to articulate to people I've been talking to about this. And you've done it very succinctly and quite well. Also bring in data to back up your claims. Could you run us through the central argument in that article? And I will link it in the show notes below for those who are tuning in. But if you could just give us a synopsis of what's going on there in your article.
Yeah, I mean, this all started because I was seeing some stuff online and in some newspapers. The New York Times did a thing, you know, is this the end of cities? I'm hearing from people, you know, like me, who come from privilege, that have decamped from their downtown home to a cottage or whatever with this notion. And they're like, I don't know if we'll ever come back because, you know, cities are dangerous and all this stuff about how urban density is the reason the virus has spread. Mm-hmm. And the future will be an era where we reject some of that density and go back to a kind of suburban or rural living. And it never sat right with me, but it was hard to find, you know, real arguments until we got neighborhood by neighborhood level data from the city of Toronto showing the number of COVID cases in each of the city's, let's just make sure I got the number right here, 141 neighborhoods, mm-hmm. or 140 neighborhoods. And look at the number of cases and also the rate. So the rate per 100,000 people. So once we had that data, I could do analysis and say, okay, like, is it true that in more dense neighborhoods, there has been higher rates of COVID cases? So I took the 30 neighborhoods with the highest rates of COVID and the 30 neighborhoods with the lowest. Mm-hmm. And I've been keeping this in analysis current. So this is, numbers are a bit different than in my article, which is a couple of weeks ago, but the message is basically the same. So in the 30 neighborhoods with the highest level of COVID, the average population density is about 5,800 people. In the bottom 30, the neighborhoods with the fewest COVID cases, those 30 neighborhoods, the density is about 5,700 people per square kilometer. So you're basically looking at the same. Between the neighborhoods with the highest COVID and the lowest COVID, you're at about 5,800-ish people per square kilometer. And to put that in perspective, in the top 30 neighborhoods for COVID, the average rate per 100,000 people is 900-ish. And in the least hit neighborhoods, we're looking at 114. So the top 30 neighborhoods have been hit about 9 times worse than the bottom 30, but the density is basically the same in both groups of neighborhoods.
So the density is not a factor, but there are corollaries. And what are those?
So then I wanted to look at income because, you know, what you could see from the map is that the neighborhoods that were hardest hit were in the northwest and northeast parts of the city, sort of the shoulder areas of Toronto. And as you'd know, Rob, from you know, working at City Hall and seeing some of the stuff, like, you know, whenever you see that on a map, the thing that jumps to your mind is income, because mm-hmm. the income map of Toronto is that there's, you know, a pretty wealthy area in the downtown core. And then as you go up through the middle, through like Yonge and Eglinton-ish, the income goes up as you get to the middle of Toronto. And then the poverty is sort of clustered in the corners of North Etobicoke and North Scarborough in particular.
Yeah.
So the map of COVID cases look a lot like that, which made me think, okay, maybe there's a real strong correlation between COVID rates and income. And what I found when I did that is the top 30 neighborhoods have about 23% of people under the low income cutoff. So 23% of the population is classified as low income. And in the bottom 30, the number is 15. So we have about an 8-point spread there in terms of income.
So in other words, for those listening, the poorer you are, the poorer community that you live in, the greater, the higher the rate and the risk is of COVID-19, of catching it, transmitting it, and the like. Can you explain why that might be the case, other than perhaps access to services? I wouldn't know. Well, I do know where to start, but I would love for you to to touch on that.
I mean, there's lots of different reasons, but I think when you look at, you know, the lived experience of being below that low income cutoff in Toronto, of being low income, of living in poverty, you know, there's a tendency for those people to be working the kinds of service jobs that would not be, you know, jobs where when this all started, it was like, okay, you can work from home because, you know, all you do all day is look at a spreadsheet, so it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these were jobs where it was like, you got to get into the factory or the behind the counter doing takeout food or in the kitchen or, you know, all kinds of things like that. So a lot of these people were getting on a bus, and you can actually see the TTC put out a list of routes that were still overcrowded during the early days of the pandemic. And all those routes correlated really well to where we are seeing these hotspots of COVID in neighborhoods in Toronto. So, you know,
transit patterns are a thing. I mean, even just going to a lot of these areas can be food deserts. So even just to go get groceries, they would have to hop on a bus. I mean, yep. I could walk down the street and grab whatever food I want without even interacting, coming within 6 feet of a person if I don't want to. But some of these folks have to get on crowded buses just to do the basic daily things. And obviously that correlates a lot with it. So in the end, you know, the point of us going through all this is that, and part of the thesis of your article was that density is not the issue, despite everyone talking about how everyone should start rethinking density, urbanism, and cities. It is a poverty issue. It is a lack of services issue. It is an infrastructure issue. It is an accessibility issue. And that is super important, because when it comes down to city planning, a lot of people are starting to rethink things. I've seen every hot take from Richard Florida to whoever the other gurus are. I haven't been keeping a lot of tabs on the guru hot takes on in the planning circles. Maybe you have, but do you get the same sense that I do? Is that a lot of people are looking at this as an opportunity to rethink density rather than look at it through a class-based lens?
Yeah, I think a lot of the people who live a certain kind of life, a life of privilege, a life where they have a certain kind of job and a certain income sometimes, and I'm guilty of this too, you sort of get locked into that worldview and don't remember to think about, you know, how your experience is different from somebody who is on the low income side of things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's easy for, it's easy for me because I worked from home before, but, you know, somebody who worked an office job might be thinking, well, now, you know, we're going to see, you know, a huge percentage of the population go work from home. So that means we have to rethink transit, and maybe, you know, it's an opportunity to save some money on buses or whatever. But, you know, you have to remember that the poverty rate in Toronto is about 20%. Like, that's one in five people. And there's a huge and growing service sector that does not lend itself to work from home at all, because
nope.
that's just not the way. Unless you have a commercial kitchen in your house, it's just not going to work.
Right.
So that there's that side of things. And I worry about it a lot. And one of the motivating factors is because the trend that we've seen in Toronto for, you know, the entire time I've been covering City Hall, and, you know, a decade at least before, is that lower income, middle class neighborhoods in the downtown area have basically been disappearing as people like me, you know, move back to Toronto and live downtown. So a lot of lower income people have been pushed out to what we call the inner suburbs. So those areas in North Etobicoke, North Scarborough. And it's very, very hard for the city to provide effective social services to those areas compared to downtown. You know, a neighborhood like Regent Park is a compact area of downtown. You know, lots of, I wouldn't say lots, but there's affordable housing there. And, you know, to provide social services in that area means having to provide social services to an area that's compact. And it's, a few blocks. Whereas if you talk about some of these sprawling areas out in the suburbs, how do you do that? You know, these people, they don't have a subway or a streetcar network. It's all just buses, and buses that are often underfunded. So it just becomes a very difficult proposition. And I really worry about a situation where, you know, those neighborhoods are just further abandoned, you know, where the richer people just decide to decamp again from downtown and go back to the suburbs, you know, outside the city. And we end up with this just sort of ring of poverty in a city that is likely to be in some period of austerity, budgeting wise, for a number of years.
Yeah.
So I worried about that sort of density is the enemy lesson taking hold in a way that's really actively harmful to the people in the city that, you know, need city services and need a government that gives a damn about them.
And I think it's not just about the city planners taking that approach. It's also about market forces are starting to shift. At least anecdotally, I'm seeing that they're starting to shift in terms of what they're thinking future demand will be like, because the conversation has been a lot around how density and urbanism can be a threat to your well-being through the lens of this pandemic. A lot of people are highlighting how, for example, Tess Kalinowski, a colleague of yours at the Toronto Star, wrote an article today about how condos are being designed for end user instead of the investment classes. Which might start to rethink density and where you can have those kind of redesigned condo units. You have the Huffington Post a couple weeks ago talking about capital flight happening among the wealthiest in Toronto, relocating permanently in Muskoka. And there are all kinds of shifts currently happening. And because of that, market demand might initiate, at least from my perspective, might initiate a new era of suburban sprawl. Do you suspect or fear that might happen?
I worry a lot about it. You know, I think the history of cities shows, you know, the decampment to the suburbs, the white flight, this hollowing out of cities that occurred over, you know, a few decades from the 50s onwards. And then, you know, there was a movement back the other way towards downtown living, which, you know, I don't want to cast as a universally good thing or even a good thing generally, because there's lots of gentrification concerns that are tied up in that, and the way it was done was not the right way to do it. But I do think, you know, if we were to see a mass exodus of people from Toronto, you know, it would not sort of spark an era of affordability in Toronto. I just think it would spark an era of deepening inequality and increasing poverty. And like I said, I'm worried about all of this happening against a backdrop where, you know, the city is saying they're almost out of money for this year. I would expect at some point we will hear about more money coming to Toronto to support operations. But I am very worried that, you know, that bailout money will be good for 1 year, maybe 2 years, and then we'll be back to having conversations about how there just isn't any money at the city for services. And, you know, if there is not, you know, aren't people looking out for that and, you know, living in Toronto and, you know, pushing councillors to make the right decisions, you know, I just worry about where that could go.
We lived through we existed through the Rob Ford era where property tax increases was a four-letter word among mentioning it in the press and around. But have you seen a shift in the acceptability of people kind of wanting or being more reasonable in accepting property tax increases beyond the rate of inflation or under whatever John Tory is pushing every year? Do you think that might be something that the public would be digestible to the public in the future?
I think to some degree. I mean, it turned out I wrote probably like at least a dozen columns over the year that was basically just like, please stop with this property tax at or below the rate of inflation thing. It's really hurting Toronto. And the thing that finally saw some movement on it, I mean, it's actually a Rob Ford thing with the Scarborough subway, where it was like he introduced a property tax levy to pay for that finally, because the whole private sector paying for subways thing didn't pan out. And then John Tory got into the whole notion of being okay with special property tax levies to pay for certain things, even if they meant property taxes as a whole were going up above inflation. And I think it was helpful in the sense that, I mean, that's happened basically three times now over the last 5 or 6 years. And at none of those occasions was there like a massive revolt at City Hall, people coming down with pitchforks saying, I can't believe you're doing this to my property taxes. It really, I think, proved the case that Toronto's property taxes, which we knew from data, were on the low side to begin with. So compared to other GTA municipalities. So, you know, raising them a bit to fund something specific was not a major issue for the vast majority of people. And I don't think it'll be an issue for the next election either. So, you know, yeah, maybe there's a case at some point where you have a special property tax levy to fund, you know, costs related to COVID recovery. I don't think it's ideal in the sense that like property taxes are not a progressive tax system.
No. They were always problematic. It's ridiculous to tie all the city services to property taxes. I mean, we do get some of our funding from elsewhere, but definitely the property tax increase is like a something that you cannot speak of. It was definitely a Rob Ford thing in the sense that, as you mentioned, the Scarborough subway tax was introduced, or transit infrastructure lever, however they put it on the property tax forms. And I remember that year we would go around door to door pointing out to Rob Ford supporters that this was in Rob Ford, in Ford country, as they like to say. And we would point out to them and say, look, you know, this is for the Scarborough subway tax. This is the Scarborough subway tax. This is for the Scarborough subway. You live in North York. He introduced that to this, and they still would not believe it. So it's more, and it had zero resonance on the ground, and this was pre-election. So at that point, I realized that it was less a property tax argument. It was more about who was arguing it. So I personally, you could increase it 10% and there would be no backlash as far as that goes, as long as you don't have someone who comes along screaming about it in the press every day, daily, a monotone way, as Rob Ford used to do in the past. Shifting a little bit away from that, looking at sections like the financial district. Mm-hmm. Now, this pandemic has highlighted that a vast majority of companies have switched to at-home, kind of work-from-home situations, and shown that they could operate that way. A vast majority of people will look to keep their situations of working at home as a perk of how they worked, as long as, and if the data shows that the productivity stays the same among some of these companies and that they didn't take any real productivity hit, could you not see a situation where a lot of the commercial buildings in the financial district start becoming vacant because suddenly they don't have to operate these giant office spaces. What are your thoughts on that? And then what would become of the financial district, in which is a single use prime real estate area of Toronto, which has always kind of been a weird thing that it's completely empty after 5 p.m. But yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, Toronto is interesting in the sense, like, when I've gone to Chicago is a good example of this, where like they have this whole loop area downtown that is like totally dead after like 7:30 at night, you know, any day of the week. Toronto, I think, is better designed in some respects, although Chicago is an amazing city, just in the sense that like there's the Bay Street corridor that does hollow out after at night, but for the most part, we do a pretty good job of having neighborhoods that are well used. You know, all hours of the day in the downtown core. So I always saw that as a mark in our favor. But as far as people working from home goes, I think it's a matter of percentages. And I think that's the debate that we're having. There will definitely be a percentage of employees that will become permanently, or for the most part, work from home after this, you know, but is it 5%? Is it 10%? Is it 25? Is it 50? I tend to be on the side where, like, over time, I don't see, like, you know, half the workforce becoming work from home. I think, you know, for some people, it works really well. I like working from home. I always have. But, you know, I've been talking to other people who've been doing it for the last few months, and they're ready to
they're
go
going
back.
Crazy.
Yeah, especially if you have kids around.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But,
forgot
and then
about
you
that.
Have situations, you know, like we know couples that are trying to make two people work from home work in like a 500 square foot condo, you know, and that goes back to some of the
it's
urban
like working
living
in
stuff.
An elevator with
people. Yeah, exactly. You know, you're working on ironing boards or whatever service you have around. So, you know, I do think like there's not going to be just this massive, you know, majority percentage move. I think it'll work itself out where it'll be, I hope it'll be pretty healthy, where it's like, yeah, you know, there's a lot of what I always hated about working in an office was this feeling like, you know, I got to be sitting at a desk between a certain, you know, like 9 a.m. in the morning until 5 o'clock.
Yeah, the industrial model.
Like I'm sitting here just waiting until an arbitrary time on the clock ticks to that so I can leave, even though my work is done. And like, yeah, that always felt ridiculous.
The clock watching model.
Yeah. So I think, you know, if we can see some of that change, that's great. But I'm not on the side where this is going to be like a massive, massive shift over the long term. That said, you know, if there's an opportunity to look at some of these buildings on Bay Street and say, you know, maybe there is an opportunity to take like a bank tower and, you know, throw some affordable housing in there. That'd be
right?
Like a cool little
cool
shift.
Conversion.
Yeah, it'd be symbolic in a way. It's like, okay, now we got, you know, the financial people in their suits, and then a couple floors up or a couple floors down, we got some affordable housing. Works for me.
The issue, though, there is that, I mean, let's say, you know, a weird turn happens and that starts to become a thing where there's increased vacancies in those buildings. Those buildings provide a huge amount of commercial property tax mm-hmm. for the city. So that would just simply compound a lot of the financial troubles that the city's currently experiencing. So that yeah. could spiral completely out of control. I mean, I don't know what the number is. And I remember Kristen Wong-Tam, who represents the area, Councillor Kristen Wong-Tam, used to cite it often in discussions about property tax. But I do believe it was in the majority range of commercial property tax comes out of that area.
Yeah, no, it's a huge, huge amount of revenue for the city coming from those office towers there. So you'd have to figure that out. It's never made a ton of sense to me why commercial property taxes are so much higher than residential property taxes in Toronto, considering that commercial, when you look at like the services used for a resident versus a business, like it's way less for a business in terms
right.
of what they get. You know, they're not going to parks. They're not, you know, you're not seeing businesses that go and use a splash pad at a park or something like that, right? Like it's not, they get a benefit from the TTC for sure. And, you know, there's some business services and stuff like that, but to justify charging, you know, twice as much for commercial properties versus residential properties does not make a ton of sense to me, but it was done because, you know, residents vote and businesses don't. So
it's also a way for city council to basically get their piece of commercial or corporate tax, essentially. It's a,
yeah.
In essence, it's a way to make the tax regime, quote unquote, more progressive in that sense.
There's definitely that. Yeah.
So I want your take on, and I'm not sure if you've been paying enough attention or any attention to this issue. I'm not saying enough is, but any amount, because it really hasn't been highlighted as much as I'd like it to be, how developers are trying to shoehorn in their projects under the idea that they need to get it through before the market collapses. They need to get their project started. They're losing all kinds of money. They're bypassing traditional statutory public meetings, which are the meetings that people attend when a development proposal is put forward, where city staff, maybe the city's representative or counselor, and the developers and the community all get in one big room and they start discussing the project because it has an impact on everyone. I'm seeing intensely controversial development projects, just like the Bombardier lands, the Downsview lands, 600 prime acres of real estate in the middle of Toronto, being thrown to a webinar as part of the statutory public meetings. And I'm saying that this is criminal. Have you been hearing a lot about that and how developers are kind of taking advantage of the current situation?
Yeah, I think the thing that I found most interesting was in the Globe and Mail, Jeff Gray had an article about the ministerial zoning orders that had been issued and how government is issuing a lot more of them than have been issued by past governments. And that took me by surprise. I mean, my prior...
Can you explain a little bit to those watching what a ministerial order is?
There's a process that normally takes place for rezoning that involves, as you said, a great deal of consultation and public meetings, public notices, and reports from planning staff and all this stuff. But the minister at Queen's Park, what's the title right now? Minister of Housing, something and something.
Yeah.
Has the ability to just announce a zoning order, which is basically just saying, okay, this is happening. And it skips a lot of the process that you would go through normally. And there's been a bunch of these that Jeff Gray wrote about that had been issued to a number of developments in the GTA and outside of it. And that worried me. I mean, I'm not a... I'm generally a YIMBY, a yes in my backyard kind of person, which, I think the city needs more housing. So more development to build more housing at any level is generally something that I'm open to. Mm-hmm. But secrecy of something like this really bothers me. This, doing it this way, you establish a process for a reason that has a certain level of consultation, a certain level of
buy-in.
Back and forth. Yeah, buy-in, you get that support, and then you do something like this, and it really, I think, this is why people lose faith in the process in the first place. And it's really rough, I think, for municipal politicians, because it doesn't, people spend so much time in politics saying, well, that's not us, that's Queen's Park, or that's Ottawa,
yeah,
or that's City Hall, but the public doesn't
shifting
really care.
The buck.
They don't really care about these divisions. So mm-hmm. if, some project gets approved in this kind of way and then starts going up, the city council is going to get blamed for it, even if it wasn't anything to do with them. So yeah. I don't think that's a fair way to handle things. And, it's been a bit of a hallmark with this provincial government to, offer things to developers in a way that, is very is skewed towards, let's just get this happening. Let's build this thing.
Because, yeah.
Ontario is open for business now. So, like I said, I generally like the idea of, housing being built. I like it when it's affordable housing as a component of it. But I do, when I read that article in the Globe, I sort of thought, that's an interesting way of going about things.
Yeah, I think, and I'll link that article in the show notes below for those interested. And I haven't read the article, but did he do an analysis, cross analysis with donors in terms of those who received the ministerial orders? Because that's usually the go-to when you're starting to see those things.
Yeah, we'd have to go back and check the article, but there's definitely have been, there's a lot when you go through like the who donated to the PCs in the last election, or who donated to, if it's like Ontario Proud that were very involved in the election. Ontario Proud was, very, very funded by,
There's a some
I think it
oil
was.
interest out in Alberta. I think
Well, it
that
was a
was one of them.
developer.
Oh
Yeah,
yeah.
it was a developer. So like that's there's been a friendly relationship between the development industry and this provincial government since the word go. So I think that's always something that you need to be looking at.
So do you think we're ushering in a new era of bad development just because of this? There's gonna be a blip on this thing.
Yeah, I
I'd be
mean
curious
the
to see like who,
yeah.
where these developments are and like what kind of developments they are or
Yeah.
whatever, but yeah.
What I worry about is like missing an opportunity. Like there's at City Hall right now, there's a pretty good amount of support, probably more than I've ever seen for, at the very least, saying to a development, you got to have affordable housing in here. And
Right.
I think it's a missed opportunity that inclusionary zoning was not something that stuck around, where you would say to a developer, okay, you can build this thing, but you got to say have 10% or whatever the percentage is of units be designated as affordable units that are offered for, a rents below market value. Levers like that could have been pulled. And if there's going to be a slowdown in the market, and what we're seeing is just sort of a rush to get projects that were in the works built, that really threatens the city's ability to see affordable housing built to the level that they'd like to see it built
Right.
to, because the private sector was a big piece of that. Even through like the Housing Now program, it's looking at city-owned land. Like there's still this idea that these projects are going to be a mix of affordable rental and also some market stuff. So you work with a partner to make that happen.
Right.
So yeah, I worry about, I've thought about this a lot. Like Toronto's been in sort of a development boom for almost 20 years to various degrees. And when we come out of this boom, we're going to look around and say, wow, we built all this housing, and how much of it was actually affordable?
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be a shame.
Interesting, and I can't imagine what's going to happen a year from now in terms of all those pieces, whether it's the property tax, the commercial property tax piece, whether it's all the ministerial orders, the bad development, the lack of accountability, lack of statutory public meetings, or at least them shoving it through some other vehicle, pressures by the development industry, the market going through the floor, people, the capital flight, all those things. It's anybody's call to see. Anybody's guess to see what's going to happen, and then but shifting gears just a little bit, only because I wanted to touch on this just slightly, because I haven't been paying too much attention to it, but it's still something I want to ask you about, and that's Sidewalk Labs. And I would like you to explain to me what happened there. Explain to me like I'm five, like ELI five, as they say on Reddit. But Sidewalk Labs is Google's pet social engineering through technology project that was supposed to happen on the city's waterfront, and for some reason it collapsed in all of this. What happened there?
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, we got word there was an event that was going to happen down on the waterfront, and it was pitched as a big deal, and the mayor was there, and I think the prime minister was even there. But it was this big announcement that Google, technically it's Alphabet, Google's parent company. This is a sister company to Google called Sidewalk Labs. It's all about, is there a way that a tech company can, get involved in urban planning and, bring some of their technology ideas to urban planning? So they announced that they were going to be building this thing on Toronto's waterfront. And the land in question was a 12-acre piece of land right at the bottom of Parliament Street called Quayside. So this, came in with a huge amount of fanfare, exciting announcements, the city of the future, Google's involved, where Canada tends to love it when an American company pays attention to them. So there was some of that going on.
Yeah. Bit of fanboying a little bit.
Exactly. But then, it pretty quickly developed, people started asking questions. It was like, so what exactly are you, do you want to do here? Like you're a tech company. Google has had its issues with privacy and the use of data in the past. I mean, they're primarily an advertising company in the sense that, yeah, they offer like a product like Gmail, but the way that they make money off Gmail is they basically like scan your emails for keywords and they'll show you an ad next to the message saying, hey, you know, it looks like you're interested in, you know, patio lights. Here's a good deal on patio lights. So there was concern about how that sort of intersects with planning. And it became clear that, you know, the city, Waterfront Toronto, who was involved as the agency doing the city's waterfront development, and Sidewalk Labs didn't really have a lot of good answers in the early stages. One of the things that people who have really followed this closely have pointed out is it was, instead of, you know, bringing in people local to Toronto to work on this project in the initial stages, it was a lot of people from the U.S. coming up to Toronto and sort of just assuming that everybody would love them and that it would be a slam dunk project. And that did not pan out in a positive way for them. So Sidewalk, you know, made some adjustments. They hired more local people, including, you know, a former city councilor in Mary Margaret McMahon. Mm-hmm. But, you know, by that point, the opposition was really starting to build up. You know, the city's tech community had taken a look at this and had a lot of questions about, you know, what was actually happening and what the rules would be around data collection. Because, you know, the part that seemed new to this versus a traditional development was Google was talking about all the sensors. You know, it would be like, okay, they're going to have a sensor in the sidewalk so we can see how many people are walking by this sidewalk. And there'll be, you know, sensors in the garbage chutes in the buildings so that we can track how often people are throwing stuff out and how much they're recycling and all this stuff. And maybe there's some good ideas there. But when you start talking like that, people start getting a little bit like, I don't know about that.
Who wants to be on a conveyor belt, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So that wasn't helping at all. And then, this is quite the saga, we got word that not only did Google have a plan for that 12-acre piece of land called Quayside, they also had a plan for the Portlands. And the Portlands is that giant industrial area of the waterfront. Mm-hmm. Just to the east of that site they were looking at, and it's massive. Like, it's right. Basically the size of downtown Toronto. It's, you know, in rough walking distance to downtown Toronto. So it's a huge opportunity. It's long been held out as like, this is the next big frontier in Toronto. There's so much potential here. How many cities would love to have this undeveloped area of the city so close to the core that they can basically do anything with? And it turned out Google was sort of coming in with this idea that, you know what, just sort of give it over here and we'll do something real nice with it. And that really turned a lot of people off as well. So you had, you know, three major factors at this point. You had the idea they started with a bunch of Americans coming up and acting like it was a done deal, even though it wasn't. You had the data concerns and the privacy stuff that wasn't really addressed in a way people were satisfied with. And then you had this feeling like not only were they just looking at, you know, a 12-acre piece of land, which is sizable, but like there's been lots of developments about that size on the waterfront over the last few years, so it wasn't out of step with what we've been seeing. Suddenly they're looking at like the giant section of waterfront, the last real remaining piece, and just sort of making that assumption. I looked at it and thought it was very presumptuous, like, oh, you've just decided you're getting this too. And those three factors led to, you know, a mounting opposition. You know, Block Sidewalk was a group that emerged out of this and really, I think, got a lot of attention through their efforts. And at a certain point, it just, you know, there was so much lobbying at City Hall about this, and there was no lobbyist that was lobbying more than the Sidewalk Labs people. But they did, they couldn't really get it to work, and it became clear at a certain point that Waterfront Toronto was not going to let them do the Portlands. It was just going to be this 12-acre piece called Quayside. And, you know, I think all that plus the COVID stuff resulting in concerns about the market led to Sidewalk announcing recently that they were not going forward with it. And that was the end of that saga. And it's frustrating. Like, I hate stories at City Hall where it's like this, a thing that happens for like years and years and years and takes up all kinds of time and all kinds of oxygen in the room and then basically amounts to nothing. Yeah. And Waterfront Toronto is trying to save face and say, you know, we're going to be able to use the stuff that we learned about data and privacy, and like, this is going to be valuable for the city and city planning and all this stuff. But I'm not sure I really buy it. Like, I think ultimately we'll look back on this and say, wow, that was a big waste of time. Like, we spent a lot of time on a project that went nowhere. And it really would have been nice if just early on they had said, you know what, before we spend all this time on consultation and writing reports, like let's have a vote on a council about the general idea and, you know, get some political buy-in for this thing before it becomes something that's just going to take up a whole lot of time.
Yeah, it's like Silicon Valley's version of the monorail that never came about.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very frustrating because even from a staffer's perspective, when it first came on site, I was like, what is this thing? I have a pretty robust tech background, and I don't even understand why the need, other than people are fascinated that Google is taking an interest in Toronto. This is a joke, and I don't know what's going to happen here other than a bunch of lobbyists are going to get rich off of it, and a bunch of bad, well-intended but bad second and third order effects are going to happen here. And why? We have incredible amount of real estate value in Toronto. Why are we handing it over to some American company? I don't understand it. And to be honest, even though it's sad that a lot of energy has been spent on the project, I'm kind of glad it's gone because we don't need them. I don't think we need them. So maybe that's a good thing that came out of, you know, planning and the COVID crisis. But thank you for that explanation, and I'm sure the listeners and the viewers will get a kick out of that very concise rundown of what happened and why it happened. And maybe it's a cautionary tale for the future. Matt, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Is there anything further that you would like to comment on? Or
no, this was a fun conversation.
I always love your analysis from, it's always, I always tell people it's like, it's an analysis from 60,000 feet plus the granular millimeter level as well, all combined in a beautiful sandwich that I love digging into. And I also want to make sure that people know and are reminded about your City Hall Watcher independent newsletter. They can subscribe to that for $5 a month, and they can just look online to see that. Make sure that they follow you on Twitter at GraphicMatt. It is the essential account to follow when you want an actual knowledgeable understanding of what is going on the ground level in the city's politics, culture, and everything in between. Matt, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I hope to have you on again if you will so come on again. You were a fascinating guest, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Matt. And everyone else, I appreciate you tuning in. Again, if you have any questions or concerns, you can email us info@pod6.com. That's info@pod6ix.com. Any questions and concerns? Any show ideas, any guest ideas, feel free to message us there. Again, you can check us out on YouTube. You can check us out on Facebook. You can check us out in whatever podcaster, podcatching app that you use, except for Apple Podcasts. I haven't gone down that road yet because I have something a little bit of a bias against Apple. They're just weird to me for some reason. But certainly on Spotify and your Anchor and whatever else, you can listen to this in audio format. And remember to tell your friends and share whatever info you got. Again, I will post a lot of the info in here in the show notes down below, so make sure you click on those and work through those. And we'll see you again in the next one. Thanks.